the SARS-CoV-2 virus, this little critter, this little obnoxious little thing, has the ability to enter the human cell with a degree of specificity that we have rarely seen before.
Where does fact end and hysteria begin? Get a clear sense of what's really going on with COVID-19 in today's episode of the Genius Network podcast. In this episode, Dr. Mansoor Muhammad and Joe Polish discuss how to get through this pandemic with adaptability, health, and a level head. Dr. Mansoor Muhammad will also reveal what they aren't telling you about the quarantine and what we may be doing to unknowingly increase our risk. If you'd like to join world-renowned entrepreneurs at this year's Genius Network annual event, then apply today for your invitation to attend. If you'd like to learn more about the Genius Network annual event or to apply, go to geniusnetwork.com.
Hey, this is Joe Polish. In these very trying times, I'm doing everything I can to not just help our business owners and entrepreneurs with their businesses, but things related to COVID-19 and the pandemic. And what could I possibly share with everyone that would be really helpful for them? So I asked one of the top genetic doctors in the world, Dr. Mansoor Muhammad, if he would give a presentation and then do Q&A with our members. And the questions that he was asked, what he went over related to food and health and the virus and explaining it. People so loved that they asked us, could we share this video for their family, their friends? And so I'm just going to make this public. So go ahead and watch it. Listen to the questions at the end. There's nothing here that's being sold. I think you'll find it incredibly useful. And I wish you the very best. And I hope you get a lot out of this presentation.
Dr. Mansoor is the president and COO of the DNA Company, a leading an innovative provider of comprehensive functional genomics testing and consulting and an industry-first individually customized supplements. He is widely regarded as a pioneer in medical genomics and has been the recipient of multiple academic and industry awards. He's the holder of several patents in the general field of molecular diagnostics and genomics research and is also one of the most sought-after national and international conference speakers in the genre of personalized medicine. What else should people know about you so they just even have some context of who you are? And then I'll just let you take it from here. How about that?
Thanks, Joe. It's such an honor to have you to have me on. So what else do you need to know about me? Probably nothing much. I don't have a race in this horse, anyone. This is not about selling anything. We have nothing to benefit from COVID. My goal here is really just to share. I do the only thing that I guess that I have, I'm privileged to know, like Joe, I'm privileged to know some really smart people all over the world, and I have access to them. All I wanted to do was share some of this and make sure that we cut through. You know, if someone asked me, Joe, if someone asked me to write a book on what's going on, I would probably call it the yin yang of a pandemic, because it really just has this duality. It has this duality that borders between the seriousness of what's going on and then the hysteria and the hype of what's being represented of what goes on. And finding your path through that duality, I think, is where most North Americans find ourselves. We're trying to wade through fact from fiction, sensationalism from seriousness. And that's the goal for today's conversation. There are a few things that we do need to remind each other. And there is a subset of information that I think needs to be discussed because it's not being discussed. And Joe, that's what you've asked me to talk about, and I will get to that. So the first thing that I really want to say to the community is this. Is this a pandemic? The answer is absolutely yes. Is it serious? The answer is absolutely yes. However, should we be... You know, should there be mass hysteria? Should we be buying into the constant reel of sensationalized, you know, headings one after the next? And the answer is resoundingly no. And I'm going to be discussing and I'm going to be addressing a couple of these points. Before I do so, I want to share something with you to act as a pivot for everything I'm about to say. And now I'm going to bring myself as the genomicist in the room. I want to share this with you. In the human brain, one of the most important neurochemicals that is at play is serotonin. There are a couple of genes that control how the human brains respond to and develops under the influence of serotonin and other neurochemicals. And one of these most important genes is known as the SLC6A4 gene. So this gene, and there's the TPH2 gene, and I'm not here to try to wow you with the names of genes, but the point of it is that the human brain is under the influence of these powerful neurochemicals. When a mother is pregnant, and if during pregnancy she's under stress, so that mother, she has two pregnancies in two parallel universes. In one of those parallel universes, she's loved There's very little stress in her life, or at least nothing that she can't handle. She has a sense of well-being. She has a sense of purpose. She has a sense of her future, i.e. she would say, if you asked her, do you have a good life? She would say yes. The influence of those emotions on the child that she's carrying is profound. In that parallel universe, there's the exact mother with the exact fetus, baby, child that she's carrying. But in that universe, she's under constant stress. Her cortisol levels are elevated. She's under stress because she's concerned about her livelihood. Where is it going to come from next? She's concerned about, she's fearing for herself. She's fearing for the time of the birth of her newborn child. She's fearing for the environment that her newborn child will be born into. Because of the elevated cortisol in the parallel universe mom, and because of certain genetic phenomena, including those genes, the SLC6A4 gene, the BDNF gene, the TPH2 gene, to name just a few, the child in that parallel universe that is born to the mother under stress, his or her amygdala is literally, during the embryonic development, smaller and more condensed. And that child is born immediately, and this is not to be fatalistic, but that child is born with a knee-jerk response, a reptilian response to everything. With that smaller, denser amygdala, that child's response to fear, to challenges, to, you know, difficulties in his or her life is completely different because of this embryonic development than the child born to the same mother in the different parallel universe. So I start with this not to be pessimistic or fatalistic, but I start with this to show, and it was really cued when I listened to Andre speak, I listened to his experiences, I listened to the work that Stedman is doing. It just cues me and it reminds me how much different environments impact people. And we think about it, okay, it impacts us in the life's choices we make. But before we're even making those choices, before we're even given the chance to make those choices, it's affecting us in the womb of our mother. And so for the women who've been blessed to carry children, and think about this societally now, we're speaking of how many women are pregnant right now. You know, it's a statistic, it's not even being spoken of, but how many women are pregnant right now and are pregnant in a time, and this is a generational event, are pregnant in a time where they're either there, their partners, their spouses, loved ones are at risk for being ill, obviously the acuteness of the illness, are at risk for financial ruin, are being cooped up indoors and so on and so forth. When you take a look at something like a pandemic, appropriately, we're looking at the acuteness of the disease, but far too often, we don't take the time to look at the ripple effect, to look at the repercussions, the deeper, the things that after this pandemic has passed through the world, and it will pass through, God willing. But after it's passed through, human beings are left behind. And we're left behind with the experiences, and we're left behind in the health that we're left behind with after the pandemic. And that health isn't just about whether you fought off a viral bug or not. That health is going to leave indelible impressions on our psyche and our behavior. And I started with something quite profound, that it can even set the stage in embryonic development for that child's future. It will literally set the stage for the brain development of that child. And this is not to be pessimistic, but it is to point out how and why this is so important, that we're speaking about things beyond just the acuteness of the infection. So with that in mind, and with the yin-yang perspective of what I mentioned, I'm going to talk about two things very quickly. The first is just to give an update. We spoke about a lot in that first podcast, and we really apologize for the sound quality, but a very, very quick update about what we know. Number one, we're dealing with a viral infection. Okay, so viruses, they're microbes that are unable to replicate outside of a host, outside of the human cell. Okay, so this virus has to get into our cells. Have we dealt with viruses before? We have. Is this the most dangerous virus that we've ever dealt with as a human species? The answer is resoundingly no. However, let's get this clear. This is not the common flu. The SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that is causing the COVID-19 disease, there are some unique attributes about it that the world needs to understand. And this is coming again from no politicized place, from no historical place. It just has to be known. There are a few things about this virus that must be known, and we now have good data about this. The first is that a virus needs to enter a human cell for it to do what it needs to do. And what does a virus want to do when it enters your cell? It wants to hijack your cell and usurp the machinery and the nutrients of that cell for its replication. The SARS-CoV-2 virus has the lock and key mechanism to enter the human cell better than most viruses we've seen. This little critter, this little obnoxious little thing, has the ability to enter the human cell with a degree of specificity that we have rarely seen before. Okay, so this virus, its ability to get into the human being upon exposure is exceptionally well refined, if you want to call it that. Number one, that's making this virus. Now, it doesn't say anything about its virulence or danger. It just says that when it can really easily get into the human body, the human cell. Number one. Number two, when this little critter hijacks your cells, hijacks the nutrients of your cells, and it's entering through special cells that you've heard these terms, that's entering through the ACE2 receptor. Okay, it's a cell, it's an enzyme that is expressed in the cell surface. It's expressed close to the cell surface. It's expressed on cells in the respiratory tract, particularly the lower respiratory tract, which is why we're seeing the symptomologies in severe symptomologies of difficulty to breathe, respiratory distress, up to and including pneumonia, which is really the thing that is doing in the individuals that get to that extreme level of the disease. Okay, when it gets into your cell, it is replicating at a rate that we've not seen before. It's replicating extremely rapidly, extremely quickly. So this brings up 3 points that I want to send home here. Number one, this virus has a degree of specificity to the human cell that is extremely, you know, extremely refined, extremely profound. Number one, when it gets into your cell, it is replicating extremely quickly. Even before you think you're symptomatic, your sputum, those little spitules that come out of your mouth, as I'm speaking here a bit passionately, and I'll get more and more passionate as the minutes go by, those little spitules, when you cough, when you sneeze, it's going to have per droplet more little replicated viruses than many of the other viruses we've seen before. It is replicating, for example, at about 1,000 times more than its previous cousin, the SARS virus, the virus of about 2 decades ago that caused the first SARS. It's from the same family of coronaviruses. Number three, it is replicating and leaving your body even before you actually are symptomatic. Okay, so just because you think you're not feeling well, and this has contributed to why it is spreading as quickly as it is. So are we dealing with something very serious here? The answer is resoundingly yes. How do we balance this against the fear and the hysteria and, of course, the societal disruption, which in and of itself is going to wreak its havoc if we don't do something about it? What we need to understand is there's a segment of the population that is extremely at risk. So let's just make this clear. For about 90% of the individuals who come in contact with this virus and who get infected, this is going to be a flu. It's going to be a flu. You're going to feel crappy for about 3 to 5 days for about 90% of those individuals. And then you will get over it and good for you. But for about 10% of the people that get this virus, okay, and we initially thought that this was going to be just the elder folks. We now are understanding, as the epidemiologic data come out, it's not just elder folks. Okay, so for about 10% of the individuals that contract this virus, it's going to be serious. It's not going to be a 3 to 5 day flu. It's going to be profound. It's going to be profound enough that when they run into respiratory distress, they're going to need medical care. They're going to need to get to the hospital because they can't breathe. Now, for about 2 to 3% of the population, this can be a mortal disease. It's going to be something that you can die from. So let's just quickly understand who that is. At the top of the list, any immunocompromised individuals out there, individuals who've had an organ transplant, and so, of course, they're on immunosuppressive drugs, we've got to be so careful with these. If you're the loved ones, if you're the caretakers of immunocompromised individuals, cancer patients, patients that are actively on chemo or recently have been off of chemo, immune compromised, we've got to be careful. From a comorbidity, and this is going to be very important with the things that I'm going to talk about later, the two greatest comorbidities for the average person, immunocompromised or not, are hypertension and cardiovascular comorbidities. In other words, do you currently suffer from hypertension? and type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance. So if you have these two comorbidities, one or the other or both, your risk of going into that more severe presentation has elevated. And if doubling down on that, you're older, and if doubling down on that, your overall health is weaker, this is not the common flu for you. Okay, so we've got to, as societies, with the love that we share, we've got to understand it's not about the 90% for whom this is going to be a flu. It's about the 10% of our population, and within that, the 3% of our population for which this is going to be life and death, and it's not just for the elders. Now, what's the point of this? A quick study of math tells us, when you look at the number of hospital beds that are available, whether it's here in Canada, in this beautiful country I call home, or the US, great country, or European countries, wherever it may be, there are a finite number of beds, hospital beds, i.e. a finite number of medical professionals taking care of patients for all of the things that we've got to take care of patients, whether it be, you know, acute trauma patients, whether it be mothers giving birth, whether it be whatever you've got to go to a hospital for, okay? That still has to go on. Now, if 10% of your population, any given population, if 10% of you, because of respiratory distress, need to end up going to a hospital, what we're going to do is that this is not about the virulence or the ultimate danger of the virus for the 90% of the population. What this is going to do is it's going to crash our health systems. Our health systems, none of our health systems, not in the best equipped countries of the world, is the health system designed to be able to take care of 10% of its population at any given one point in time. This is the reason that we've got to be careful. This is the reason that this is not fear-mongering. Let's get it clear. The yin and the yang. For 90% of the population, this is going to be a flu. For 10% of the population, this is going to be something far more serious, needing you to go to the hospital. And I give this analogy. You can be a 300-pound footballer, just tough as nails, and you can be walking with your two-year-old child next to you. You know, you're just going for a walk. If you're going to slip and fall, everything is overridden, and you grab for that two-year-old, knowing that that two-year-old isn't going to stop you from slipping and falling, let me tell you. Why am I saying this? When you can't breathe, when you find yourself in acute respiratory distress, and you can't get that lungs filled, and you can't feel as though you've just taken a breath, all logic, functionality leaves a human being. You need and you will want medical attention. You will call 911 or you will get a loved one and you're going to go to that hospital. If we allow our societies to get to that 10% mark, where it's 10% of the broader population, and we start seeing not thousands, but tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, not that they'll die from it, but hundreds of thousands of people needing and calling 911 and relying on our health services, think of what this is going to do to the clinicians. You want to see heroes? You want to see true heroes? Look at those clinicians, those nurses, those healthcare providers that are giving their all 24/7 to what's going on. So as a community, as a society, as of the best of societies, the Genius Network societies, led by an individual, why am I doing what I do? You know, I met Joe and it's hard to find a person with a heart as big as Joe. And so when he asked me to do this, it was just an honor to come on and speak to you all. So the first point of everything that I wanted to say is this is real. It's real not from a hysteria perspective. It's real from what I just said when it comes to the numbers. Everything that I've just told you is factual. And it's based now on when I first wrote that missive, it was March 13th. Between March 13th and now, it's barely been, 14 days-ish? Okay, in 2 weeks' time, our knowledge continues to grow. And let me tell you, it's not making me feel any more comfortable. Is it making me hysterical? No, but it's reaffirming my concern that if we don't take the steps that we need to take and we get to that point, our healthcare system can be rude, in for a rude awakening. Okay, well, that sounds a little serious, doesn't it? Well, with everything that Andre and Stedman spoke about, it's about knowing your place in this. This is not happening to you. This is happening through you. Andre, I was listening. Okay. And we've got to figure out, we've got to do a better job of isolating those who do need to be isolated and they absolutely do need to be isolated. And we've got to figure out how to do that while allowing as much of the rest of society to get back into the mode of society. If we can do so, and I'm not here with a crystal ball saying I know how to do so, but if we can do that, that is the best of all worlds, where we isolate and we treat and we love and we protect those who are. This is going to be, or could be, a life and death situation, or it could be a situation that leaves you really in a bad state of affairs for not 2 weeks, not 3 weeks, for months to come. We've got to protect that segment of the society. And then somehow, in the best of ways, with proper testing, proper facilities, allow the rest of society to get back into a mode with social distancing and taking care. Life is not going to be the same. Let me just make this clear. And this does not have to be bad. We need to be prepared for a new norm. And a new norm isn't a bad thing. A new norm is just something that we should view it as a challenge that we have overcome many such challenges in the past. We will overcome this. And by the way, it might teach us things that just prepare us to be better human beings, better caregivers, better partners, just simply better contributors to society. And we need to embrace that. But let me tell you, let me talk to you a little bit about the things that aren't being spoken of. And this is why we must be able to get our societies back into gear. Okay, well, what's happening when we quarantine large segments and we self-isolate large segments of the society? This is not, I repeat, not to question or to diminish the need for that. In fact, everything I've just said is to support the need for that. But we've got to ask something else here. When we self-quarantine, I've actually been quarantined now for about 10 days myself because I was traveling. I was actually down in Phoenix just before March 13th. I came back home. And so I've been home. What happens? What happens is this. Let's just go through practical. This is real. This is not fear-mongering. This is not exaggerating. Here's what happens. Well, you're home. It means that you're not getting, all things equal, as much sunlight exposure. Number two, all things equal, doesn't have to be this way, but we know ourselves, your home, your mobility, your exercise, your fitness, you're not paying as much attention to it. You're just kind of home. You're bumming around in your PJs or whatever else. Again, it doesn't have to be that way. Number three and four, hugely important. For the panic shoppers out there, again, that should not have been happening as a society when we think of the greater good. We don't need that. But what are people shopping for? And what are they eating while they're in self-isolation? Well, when you go into self-isolation, you buy what? You buy non-perishables. You buy foods. And what are non-perishable foods? Well, they're canned foods, they're pastas and rice, so they're carbs, and they're foods high in salt. This is not trivial. I'm not making a mountain out of a molehill here. This is a fact. Okay. Now, what does that consumption over the next 10 days, 2 weeks, a month for some individuals? Here you are, your mobility is down, you're indoors with not as much sunlight exposure, you're consuming more carbs, i.e. sugar, and you're consuming foods that are higher in salts than you are probably accustomed to because you're eating canned foods, the type of non-perishables that people tend to stock up on. You're increasing your risk for two things. You're increasing your risk for hypertension and insulin resistance. What is the two most important comorbidities of SARS-CoV-2 such that you put yourself at risk for the most serious part of the spectrum of outcome? Hypertension and type 2 diabetes. And then you might say, well, Dr. Mansoor, come on, that's not going to happen in 10 days. Your risk for hypertension over the course of 10 days to 2 weeks can radically change based on lifestyle changes that I've just described, based on dietary changes that I've just described, especially if there were latent genetic factors to begin with. So what have we done here? We've consigned whole segments of our society trying to treat the pandemic outbreak, but we've not given thought to what is the longitudinal health concerns as we're all sitting in our homes with lack of mobility. What happens when you don't get enough sunlight? You don't get enough vitamin D. Vitamin D is intimately and radically involved in your immune response. In fact, it's not just involved in your immune response. Vitamin D, which you're going to need with sun exposure, which we're not getting very much of. And by the way, it's the winter months for many of us still. It's shorter days, colder, we're bundled up, and we're indoors. Vitamin D plays an intimate role in quenching something called the cytokine storm. The cytokine storm is that vortex, that cascade, that domino effect, inflammatory response That is the thing that people are dying from. When that cytokine storm gets going and the lining of the alveoli, the lining of your delicate little balloons in the lung, those little pockets in the lung, when they become inflamed and they rapidly become inflamed and that fluid starts to build up, that's what people are hitting the mat with, forgive the expression. So again, look what's happening here. When we are quarantined, and I am not questioning the wisdom of that, what I'm putting as a word to you, your loved ones, your communities, we've got to get more healthcare providers speaking about the longitudinal effects, speaking about if you need to be home and for the loved ones and for those at risk who do need to be isolated, they need to be isolated, but not just isolated, they need to be kept in the best of health as possible, to get some sunlight in whatever means is necessary, to get some mobility and movement within your homes. This is the time for people that have their online exercise motifs and what they can contribute to our societies. This is the time for that. The final point that I want to make here is when vitamin D goes down, when you're indoors, you are affecting profound behavioral pathways. Do you know what is already happening in our communities during this period? The hotlines for spousal abuse are ringing off the hook. The hotlines for suicide are ringing off the hook. The hotline for just people being depressed are ringing off the hook. And so we are dealing with one acute issue, which does need to be dealt with, as everything I've said, but our healthcare agencies and our communities were not addressing the farther-reaching and longer-reaching issues, which equally, and I might argue, even more importantly, needs to be addressed. That ability for longitudinal health, because we're going to get over this, but we don't want to just get over this. We want to get over this healthier, better as communities, and more prepared for whatever other challenge we might face. We don't want to be going through this in a month, 2 months from now, the rates of depression, the rates of suicide, the rates of spousal abuse, partner abuse are off through the roof. And we certainly don't want to be the individuals who, because we think this is just a trivial walk in the park, we're not thinking, and because we happen to be of the 90% of the population for whom this could just be not even mildly flu-like, but we're spreading this to our communities and we're jeopardizing not just the 10%, we're jeopardizing the health system that has to deal with the ripple effect. So in conclusion, we do have to take this seriously. We have to take this seriously, but we have to be mature about it. We have to recognize this is happening through us, not to us, as Andre so beautifully put. We have to find what we can do that is better for ourselves, for our loved ones, our circles. Define your circles of influence and make the best choices for those circles of influence and purposely decide how you're going to help those circles of influence to do so. We're talking about the elders. We're talking about those that are at risk. Actually, beautifully, it's a blessing. Our children, especially young children, are beautifully, actually, epidemiologically, this is not a fallacy. They really are, it seems, quite not protected, but the severity of the disease, the severity of the SARS-CoV-2 in the children, actually, it's a blessing. It's really not that bad. Beautiful. So we're not talking about our children. Those children are the young human beings that are at home. School has been disbanded for, again, good reasons of social isolation to the degree necessary. They're at home with parents that are stressed, with parents that are facing financial difficulties. They're at home with parents who are not accustomed to being in the same home for longer periods of time. They're at home in tense situations, our children. And these children, without potentially the maturity of evaluating, this is a generational event. Most of us have not seen the like of this before and will likely not see the like of it, God willing, again. And these children, that because they're not affected by the viruses from a health perspective, from an outward flu-like viral perspective, we're not talking about the mental and emotional scarification that they can be exposed to, especially when you know how radically different some children, that's the work that we do, to look at the genetic underpinnings of, there are 20% of children in our society this type of emotional discord, of seeing their parents stressed, of not being at school, not having access to their friend network, of only having access to the great old swipe left, swipe right social media, and they're consuming sensationalized media reports, and they don't have necessarily the life skills to filter this. We're creating a scenario of anxiety. We're going to start seeing, and I want to be so wrong about this, but a month into this, we're going to start seeing sections of the population of our youth facing depression and anxiety. And this is not fear-mongering. This is not the whoa, my gosh, what's going on? What I'm saying here is, as adults, don't just think because this is a segment of the community that is not getting physically ill, that they can't be emotionally affected by the stresses that we're all facing as families. We've got to be more cognizant of this. We've got to use the networks. For everyone on this call, if you took 5% of what I had to say and we apply that, we try to just have a bit more, get to, as Stedman has put it, make a plan for yourself. So what that does is, and I'm not here trying, I can't be a pundit to people who are looking at where their next paycheck is from. So I'd be a hypocrite if I said I understand that stress. But for whatever you can do, and for those more fortunate, such as on this network, if you can do things that affect 10 more individuals, 20 other individuals, and they can, and they can, and they can, by the time we get to N of 4, i.e. degrees of separation, we can affect our societies. We can affect our societies to have a healthier approach to this pandemic. It is a pandemic. We can ensure that our healthcare systems are not being crippled. We can ensure that we're not panic buying and leaving those who really do need access to healthy foods, nutritional foods, not foods that are simply going to exacerbate the very physiology, the very concern that you need to be careful of. Let me make it clear. People with hypertension, people dealing with type 2 diabetes, dealing with insulinemias, i.e. insulin resistance, your body is not as equipped, near as equipped to handling this little critter as you might think. And so we need to do something about that. We need to do something about the mental and emotional well-being of our loved ones and the emotional and well-being of our children. They are experiencing something generational. This is a once in a generation. They do not have anything else by which to compare this to, at least in this beautiful country, whether it's the US or North America. Other countries have had to deal with things that are, you know, somewhat difficult at times. Okay, so we've got to take these things into consideration. It's about the virus. It's about the yin and the yang. There is concern, but there's no need for hysteria. And with that, I would end, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Dr. David Berg.
Yeah, those are the old days. I guess I'm still am. But Mansoor, first, thank you so much for just talking about just the importance of the fear and the anxiety that people are feeling over this, and that how it's going to affect people going forward. I'm in the middle of it right now, boots on the ground, managing 215 people here in Arizona, helping about 90,000 patients we have using our clinics and our surgery centers, and about another 10,000, maybe more than that, around the country using virtual services with us. And where my job's not doing the clinical piece, it's managing, engineering the workflow around all this. One of the things I can see is just that on the healthcare workers, oh my gosh, I've never seen so much stress on the healthcare workers right now. These are people I work with, so I know them intimately. So I know what they're capable of. I've worked with them for years and I see what they've handled before. And this is a different day right now.
It is.
Hitting on the importance of the stress that they're feeling. And I do think we're going to see a lot more of it. You know, we've done well over 3 million now, and I haven't seen this kind of thing before. And where I'm also seeing it a lot, because we do businesses all over the country, is in, I'm calling them high stakes workforces, where you just can't send people home and they're stressed and they got to work in the middle of it. So think about nursing homes. Some of our clients work in own nursing homes. Lisa Cini, who's a very good friend of me in Genius Network, she knows it firsthand too. You know, these business owners are being faced with not only economic challenges right now, but the fear of making the wrong decision, right? My cook has a sniffles and they heard the president say, or CNN say, or whoever say, I got to stay home. And now we can make really hard decisions over, does grandma get fed or get her medication, or do I risk infecting her? Those are some stresses that I've never experienced before. And so thanks. I don't really have a question. I just want to thank you for bringing that point up.
No, but it does cue me. Forgive me for interjecting. Please forgive me. It cues me when this happened. We're not. I mean, as a genomicist, obviously the genomic implications, and I do see a question here about the sex dimorphism between men and women and how the virus is entering the body, and I can speak a little bit about that if and when I answer this question. So we're a genomics company, we are a health-based company, but when I presented this, before this was thought to be a pandemic in North America, I alerted my business partner and CEO. I said, listen, this is going to be far worse because I'd looked at the epidemiological data than people are realizing, and hence I wrote that first article. You know, without a second thought, our CEO said, we diverted just about all of our resources immediately. Not just because it was, again, not because of the virulence nature of the virus, but because we knew what was going to happen to our healthcare system. And let me just, for everyone that's listening out there, you know, because you see these articles, Yahoo, is it just another sensationalized piece? This morning, I was in touch with one of my dear friends and colleagues. He's an anesthesiologist, ER anesthesiologist, in one of our big cities in Canada. They are being told to buy their own face masks. Our ER doctors are being told to buy their own face masks because the hospitals don't have any to give to these people that are putting their own lives. And I'm sorry, this is going to be a little emotional because these are people, they're giving their everything. So please recognize that this is real. So what we did as a company, and this is not a plug, we have no financial gain here. My CEO, and you know, just one of the reasons that that's one of the reasons he's the CEO and why I'm blessed to work with him. He diverted much of the company's resources, and we got, in the period of less than a week, was the fastest Health Canada Class 1 approved device. And what is this device? It's a Health Canada approved device. It's an app to evaluate symptomologies. It uses AI to evaluate your symptomologies, evaluate where you are. So because what? There are other common flus going on. There are other health things going on. And then all of the emotional stresses where you're tracking. And so we've created in no time by simply saying we wanted to do something to make a difference. And we literally diverted much of our company's resources before this was labeled a North America, you know, a pandemic that was going to affect North America. And I'm not saying this to toot what we did, not at all. I'm saying this for the business owners out there. I'm saying this that if you find that purpose that you could make a difference, if you have something, if you figured out, if you've got a resource to figure out where our healthcare providers can get masks, for heaven's sakes, contact some agencies, make it available. This is real. This is not coming. You're getting this from me. This is from our ER of Canada's fourth biggest city. And the ER doctors are being told, you got to go find your own mask. We don't have any more to give you. Why? Because
I want to double click on something you just said, is it's so much more common this is going to be the flu. And in the middle of the hype, which is very problematic, if people think that any flu symptom is a coronavirus. It's very it's not likely it is. It's getting more and more likely, but it's, and we're about to hit a second flu bump here, the flu season, right? There's always two seasons. So one of the things that we found has been really, really useful on the ground is recommending that people call us and within 48 hours so we can get them Tamiflu, or there's some other medications too that are quite inexpensive. And if we can get them that, if they're symptomatic, it'll help them feel less symptomatic and then their worry goes down. And I can't stress enough how important it is to get the worry down in these people. And that's been the biggest thing we've seen for pragmatic improvement with the people we take care of, is get them in, get them a phone call from a doctor or a nurse practitioner really quickly, get them on a medication that'll make their symptoms feel better dramatically. And if they do feel better, you can be reasonably assured it's not the coronavirus, more likely the flu or maybe a strep throat. What's interesting to me is that when we called the health department to ask them for help on the protocols and workflow, they had nothing. And that's what we're learning now, unlike ever before, is that we're probably about 3 days ahead of when the information comes out. So doctors are being asked to figure out their own protocols and like on the ground workflows of healthcare, because it just doesn't work to do what you see the CDC saying today. And tests are limited. So we have to preserve them for the people you were talking about, that some percentage of that 10%.
Indeed.
And so I'd encourage everybody here that if you're having flu-like symptoms and you want to start feeling better sooner so you can get rid of some of the mental stress, call your doctor, redirecthealth.com. There's a member number and a $49 number that I created. And the key here is just talk to somebody when you have, your symptoms are early. If you go 3 days, now you're probably going to last for 5-10 days with the flu-like symptoms, worrying your head off over what's happening.
Dr. Berg, what you've just done there, just that alone, the contribution, see, you get all of these people, you know, I hate the pundits that throw terms out there without, you know, the flattening of the curve and so on and so forth. And they're not even considering that part of this curve that we're dealing with is the curve of the strain in the healthcare system. If we can just take away from that strain, the individuals who don't have the SARS-CoV-2, who are freaking out over a fever that they might have just had because, or sniffly or something else, these are the places that we could make such a tree, you know, A, we deal with the anxiety. B, we deal with just the practicality that you don't have SARS-CoV-2. And, you know, we deal with the release of the strain on the system. So these are the things, and just one communication, what you've just done there, if that affects 50 families online, 100 families online, this is where it starts. And of course, this is why I can't thank Joe enough.
The key here is 48 hours. I see too many of my friends and my wife jokes with me all the time, but my friends are always waiting 3 to 4 days because they're all entrepreneurs and they think that 48-hour window doesn't matter to them, but it matters to us too.
So, and we'll make available the app free of charge to anyone, by the way, so that they can track, they can put in the symptoms. It's a live learning. If you want to work with us, just to get it out there, no charge, just to get it out there, so we can have people understanding they don't have to freak out over things they don't need to freak out over. Just that alone. Is going to make such a difference.
We got so many questions here. I want to see if we're even going to have to cut some off. John Raymonds, go for it.
I have a detailed question when it comes to the note that was distributed to the Genius Network group. You say that there's if people have a predisposition to suboptimal cellular methylation, it could be a risk enhancer. My knowledge of genetics is really thin. You know, I put my genome through, if I'm even pronouncing it correctly, Prometheus, you know, I can see the data, but I can't match it to your interpretation. You know, is that something that the DNA company could help with in that detail? Or
it's not something we do regularly, but it's something that we're completely capable of, and I'd be more than happy to do that for you. Absolutely.
A lot of people in Genius Network know, but I this is the dude that he owns Bronze Studios, is one of his companies of many, because John's a very smart guy. That's that one of their movies is the Joker movie that recently came out. So he's I already made that connection.
Yeah, go see The Way Back, Joe, because that didn't make it into theaters because of COVID. No, it's available now for purchase.
Wow. Yeah. Crazy how this affects everything. But yeah, so yeah, go ahead, Mansoor. What can you guys?
So absolutely. And I just want to, you know, for folks out there, again, misinformation, superficiality, the Joe knows the one thing I can't tolerate is superficiality when you're dealing with something as profound as genetics. And so for Mr. Raymonds, I'll be happy to do that for you. For the people that are listening out there, please don't go look for a blog on methylation. What you're going to get is absolute rubbish. Methylation is it's one of the most important phase 2. It's a cellular process that's hugely important, and it's hugely important in reducing inflammation. The thing that is going to get you into the weeds with this infection is a profound and acute pro-inflammatory response. In fact, the medications that are being promulgated out there that have had some successes or potential successes in general prior to the vaccine, they're all anti-inflammatories at the end of the day. Okay, so understanding your proclivity. And by the way, why then is something like type 2 diabetes? What on God's green earth does type 2 diabetes have to do with a viral infection? It's already contributing. You are in a pro-inflammatory mode. Your immune system can be compromised. So understanding some of your innate, your internal, your innate capacity, of course, that's what we do. To conclude, Mr. Raymonds, it'll be an absolute honor, pleasure. I'll work with you to get your information, and we'll pull what we need, and I can, you know, make some recommendations as needed.
Thank you. And I just got a quick question that may be way outside of your wheelhouse. And if it is, maybe you could even just offer a thought as to where to go.
Yep.
And obviously this is not an immediate question, but you know, you hear chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine as possible, you know, solutions to people's problems when they have this COVID-19. I know I'm allergic to quinine. Mm-hmm. And molecularly, I believe those are very similar.
Yes.
And that quinine allergy is like a, you know, a one in a million kind of thing. So where do you even start with the, you know, the very remote worry that if you got into a problem, the solution might be the death of you.
Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, and this is not to make a disclaimer for disclaimer's sake, I'm a doctor of genetics, which means I'm a PhD. I'm a clinical genomicist. So I do deal with patients. Nothing that I'm about to say is meant to either be even mildly considered a therapeutic.
Totally okay. Yep.
That's what Dr. David is online for. So of course, quinine, depending on how you pronounce it, it's a natural extract. It's a compound that was found in the bark of the cinchona tree. So it's a natural extract. Incidentally, folks, it's native to Peru, where they've had to deal with malaria from time immemorial. Okay. And so this quinine, through the way it works, and it works in malaria. Interestingly, it has two properties. It actually has anti-inflammatory properties. It's working at the level of anti-inflammation. There we go again. It's working at the level of bringing down the cytokine storm. But interestingly, it even seems to have, it works at the level of stopping the virus from even getting into the cell in the first place. So this is something our health agencies are and should be looking at. Now, chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine is a synthetic version of quinine. Okay. Something that I want to put out there, and this is again far more important, Dr. Stern, we can get offline. There are some protocols that I have access to because of the world network that I'm working with. The hydroxychloroquine dosing for a prophylactic dose is way less than people think. Just even one dose per week coming out of the studies of China and France, the folks that were hit first before us, one dose of hydroxychloroquine, please, listeners, do not go rush for this. You still need to speak to your clinician. But for the clinicians out there, the dosing for a prophylactic approach, there is something here that we might want to be looking at. And of course, there's some combinations that can work even better. I know I have not answered your question because I don't know when you've got an allergy or a drug reaction to quinine, will you have as visceral or as in a reaction to hydroxychloroquine? Maybe this is something that Dr. David can answer. Do we have the ability for him to chime in? The question being, if someone is sensitive to quinine or has a reaction to it, will they likely have a reaction to the synthetic hydroxychloroquine?
I have no idea. And it is way over my head. For sure.
And you know what? There's a couple of doctors that are on here. Rebecca Miller is on here. Dr. Jamie. I wanted to read her comment. There's so many comments now. Where the hell did it go? But she was, when you guys were talking about mass.
And by the way, for everyone, while Joe is doing this, one of the very best signs of a truly healer like Dr. Berg is when you don't know something, you say, "I don't know." So it's such a refreshing thing for someone to just say, "I don't know."
Very true. So Jamie wrote, when you were talking about mass, she said, that is true. I worked a shift yesterday. So she's an emergency room physician that works at the 9th busiest hospital in the United States outside of Detroit. She said, I worked a shift yesterday without adequate mass and protection. So yeah, the healthcare, it's insane. The level of just workload and stress and exposure and everything that everyone's going through. This is...
So just very quickly on that note, because I did see a question here about the sex dimorphism. So... forgive me, very quickly, for the clinicians, especially in the room, a lot of clinicians are making the mistake of confusing the ACE gene, the ACE1 gene, which is on chromosome 17, which because it's on a non-sex chromosome, we have two copies of it, men and women have two copies of it. The virus is not entering through the ACE gene, the angiotensin-converting enzyme gene, which is directly related to your angiotensin-converting renin system, hence kidney, hence blood pressure, hence cardiovascular. The virus is entering through the ACE2 gene, completely different gene. It's a homologue, which is on the X chromosome. Now, because this gene that makes a little surface receptor that the virus is binding in a lock and key model to it, because it's on the X chromosome for the men and women out there, men, we have one X chromosome. We're 46 XYs. We have one X chromosome. Females, you are 46 XX. You have two X chromosomes. So first thing, medical professionals out there, this is not the ACE gene. This is the ACE2 gene, which is on the X chromosome, not the usual, not the gene, the thing that you prescribe ACE inhibitors for, right? Your clandestartins and so forth. That's the ACE. That's the chromosome 17. That's not what the virus is binding to. It's a homolog. It's involved in some of the same processes, but it's not the same system. So that's the ACE2. Point number one. Point number two. So people have been asking me, well, gosh, if men have one X chromosome, and that's the gene on the X chromosome that is making the receptor, and women have two X chromosomes, what does this mean? Are women making twice the number of receptors for the virus? Are women's, what's, well, actually, as much as women have two X chromosomes, they block out. It's something called the bar body. They only express one of their X chromosomes at any given point in time. So don't fall into that loop about men versus. Now, does this mean that women can't be protected over men? Yes, there may be things there, but it's unlikely to do with the ACE2 gene. Just so you know, estrogens, women, by the way, men have estrogens as well, but for the female half of the population, you produce, generally speaking, higher amounts of estrogens. Estrogens, just plain and simple, by the way, plain and simple, tends to have shown some protective effects over viral infections. I am not saying over SARS-CoV-2 specifically, but it does have some benefit over typical viral infections, including coronaviruses, of which the SARS-CoV-2 is part of. Okay, so that's the other. The final clarity, just as I'm kind of ticking through these hot button items for the clinicians, good intention, a couple good intention clinicians have made a fatal conclusion regarding vitamin D. Because they think that vitamin D upregulates, makes the human body make more ACE2, and by the way, that's not very clear, hold on with me, there is some mild coming from rat studies that vitamin D increases the expression of ACE2, the thing that the virus is getting into the cells via. So then you add one and one, and you can end up with five. If vitamin D is increasing the receptor, and that is the receptor that the virus is entering through the cells, don't take vitamin D. Nothing could be further from the truth. I don't want to get into the biochemistry of it, but that was a really poor misinterpretation of the biochemical system. So I just want to tell everyone out there, the bigger concerns that you're home, you're not getting, and we're not telling people go take crazy amounts of vitamin D. Just make sure you have adequate levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D is going to be far more important in helping to quench that cytokine storm, which is the thing that's going to do you in. The other information is frankly misplaced. I know they were probably well-meaning, but it was a really 1 + 1 = 5. So these three sort of, for the medical folks out there, I just wanted to help clarify this to the degree. Please forgive me. You guys have forgotten more than I know. I just wanted to put that out there for you.
Dr. Mansoor, does that have anything to do with being deficient in vitamin A?
No. So there is some evidence that vitamin A also induces the angiotensin convertin renin system, but that is more as it relates to the ACE, the true ACE, not the ACE2, but the ACE1. Now, these two things interact at the biochemical level. So I guess the short answer to your question is this. Healthy, moderate levels of vitamin A, which you can get from foods. The thing with vitamin D is you can't get much of it from foods. You're either going to get it from the sun. There are some low amounts in foods, or you're going to have to supplement for it. And Dr. Tom Fiden, the previous head of the CDC or NIH, Dr. Fiden. Anyways, he was either the head of the previous head of the CDC or the NIH. For someone like that to come out, he actually came out and had to make a statement about 5 days ago warning people that because of the circumstantial things, their vitamin Ds will be too low, and that's a poor comorbidity. So I would get your vitamin Ds up supplementally, basic levels. Vitamin A, again, so long as you have a basic diet with enough of it, vitamin A, your beta carotene, and your retinol, the body takes in beta carotene. It has to convert beta carotene into retinol. There's a gene that does that, by the way, and some of us don't have the best version of it. It's called the beta carotene monooxidase gene. So those are the folks that if you drank too much carrot juice, you start looking yellow. If you've ever drank too much carrot juice and you start looking yellow, it's because you're not converting your beta carotene into retinol as efficiently. So all things equal, if that's you, get it from seafood. Good quality seafood is good quality, good access to retinol. Have I answered your question?
just that the interaction with the vitamin D was related to a vitamin A deficiency also.
I see what you mean. And yes, so again, balancing and making sure they're both adequate work off of each other. Yeah. My apologies. Yes.
And by the way, let me just mention, because I'll even have Rebecca share a little bit later before we end for the day. That's my friend, Dr. Rebecca Miller. She's just created a document called Be Hard to Kill. And it's about just strengthening your immune system. And, you know, when you first wrote, which again, I'm going to remind everyone to go read what Mansoor has already written, which is on geniusnetworkinsights.com. You can listen to my interview I did with him or read the transcript that we did with Dan Sullivan, which we put up on our 10X Talk podcast. There's really valuable information in these documents. Those are there. And anything else, Mansoor, that you update or provide me with, I will put it up. We also will post links in the chat box. There's a couple of questions that I'd like to, Barbara Annis, you know, who's on the line listening, she wrote, bottom line, this is impacting more in men than women, and men need to pay more attention earlier and be super aware. Neil Moore, who was just on, I think, Neil, you wanted to come on and ask a question.
Yeah, thanks, Doctor. Really remarkable. Given the environment you were talking about earlier with regards to being confined in the home, looking at the more accessible practices that could be available to all of us, things like sleep, hydration, meditation, yoga. Is there a biophysical, is there a neurochemical basis argument for the benefit of that, particularly in these times?
Say otherwise would be ridiculous. So we can reverse engineer this from seven ways from Sunday. We don't have enough sleep. We don't take care of our overall mental well-being. Our cortisol levels go up. Our immune function comes down. It's a seesaw effect that was beautifully designed from an evolution, from an adaptation, creatism, whatever you believe in. So if we are getting our cortisol levels up by virtue of excess stress, by virtue of not sleeping well, we're already going in the wrong direction. Okay. Vitamin D. And to Dr. Miller's excellent point, and the correlation between low vitamin A and low vitamin D is directly correlated, meaning low vitamin D is directly correlated to your levels of dopamine. Okay. Low vitamin D, you're indoors, your dopamine is going down. You're already stressed out. You're already worried about that next paycheck. But so double effect. Low vitamin D, low vitamin D, low and poor circadian rhythms. A point here, everyone. We are circadian creatures, okay? And so something as simple as, you're there in bed reading the last newsreel, which is giving you nothing more of it. When you read a news piece, I urge all of you, ask yourself, what did that news piece really do to change your life in a meaningful manner? And if the answer is it didn't, other than raise your blood pressure, per what we mentioned earlier, other than raise your cortisol, you've just done yourself a disservice. Now we're sitting in bed, we're trying to get to bed, we're reading these blue light emitting screens, and this is real. This is not fake science, this is real science. And what did we do? We disrupted the circadian rhythm. And when you disrupt the circadian rhythm, you disrupt one of the most important, it's not a neurochemical, it's a trophin, something known as brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And when your BDNF is suboptimal, you've just started walking down a path, again, increased anxiety, increased depression, okay? Poor response, you go into, when BDNF is low, the brain goes into what we call the hamster wheel brain. So now you're thinking about that thing three times, you're just lying there and you're replaying it over and over and over again. Who was the person that asked me that question? So brilliant. That
was Neil Moore.
Mr. Moore, Dr. Moore, forgive me. So your point in ensuring the connectivity of this from the nutrition to the societal context, to the home environment, what that does to your stress level, what that does to your sleep. This is the point that what we're dealing with here is something that will have ripple effects beyond the acuteness of the actual infection.
Thank you, Doctor.
This is an interesting one from Malad. I have a very important question by Dr. Mansoor. Could we improve our immune system by taking cold showers in about 2 minutes, two times a week, mountain climbing two times a week, and using venom of honeybees, at least using three stings of bees in each one two times a week?
Okay. So recognizing that there are folks incredibly more intelligent and skilled than me on this line. I cannot comment on the last of the three things that he mentioned as far as the venom of the honeybees. It's simply just, I don't know. And it doesn't mean that it's yes or no. I just don't know. As to the use of cold showers, as to the, you know, the work by Mr. Wim Hof and his corpus of work, we do know. And just so that you know, by the way, that BDNF gene, that gene that is so radically important for brain function, the circadian rhythm of the body, the way in which we respond to stressors, it's what is called a heat shock gene. It is stimulated through temperature changes, both the cold of it and the hot of it. So if you want to get your BDNF going, go sit in a sauna, safe sauna practices, you will actually measurably stimulate an uptick in BDNF. Cold showers in a safe manner can also do the same. So before we even get into the immune system function, these temperature changes do and can be used to upregulate things like BDNF, which can have profound effects on our mood and behavior, which of course can have profound effects on our stress levels, which can have in profound effects on our immune systems. So I just said that there's a link there through about three different levels. Now, can it have an immediate direct link on the immune system, i.e. heat shocks, temperature changes? And the research that I've seen is yes. I don't know all of the details of how it does so. I actually, my doctorate is in immunology. I designed some of the first antibodies to be used in medicine, recombinant antibodies. That's actually where I cut my teeth. As to how the temperature shocks do so. So the short answer, now, temperature changes, when done intelligently, does have benefits in the body. I stress intelligently. You have to know yourself. You have to know your limits. You have to know your overall health. The bee venom, I just don't know anything about it.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, a couple more before we wrap up. I have a question, and this is from Scott Danner. I have a question concerning immune suppressant drugs for autoimmune issues in COVID-19.
Yep, can you hear me okay?
Yep,
I don't think my wife would forgive me if I didn't ask this question on the meeting with all these doctors. I've been on an autoimmune suppressant for about a year, and I was going to cycle off in June. When I saw all this stuff happening, I decided I was no longer going to take it. Now we've been arguing as to whether or not I made the right decision or I didn't make the right decision. And I'm not asking, you don't know any of my medical background, so I'm not trying to say that you guys know the exact answer. I guess what I'm looking for is how long before the immune system starts to repair itself and rebuild? I'm extremely healthy, athletic. I eat well, I get vitamin D, and I was going into remission from Crohn's, which I was asymptomatic in the first place. So it was a very frustrating situation for me. But the point I'm getting at is I don't want to put this stuff in my body to reduce my ability to fight something off that's only going to put me in a tough spot. And so if I can do without it, I'm trying. And I just wanted input from the medical community.
The clinicians online are far better equipped to answer that question. I will answer the little that I can from a genetic and an immunologist perspective. So as to the time it takes, first I would say, any decision to take something, if you know that you're in an at-risk environment, so of course you need to gauge your at-risk characteristics because of your societal, home environment, work environment to the current infection, number one. If you feel you are in an at-risk pod demographic, doing anything that reduces your immune competency, the body, when it comes to viral infections, has to first make an IgM, the M subtype, and then that has to, over time, sometimes quite quickly, transition into an IgG response. If you snuff that down, either, of course, by very, that you have to, you do have to take additional precautions. No two ways about it. So, of course, you have to make an informed decision. Where are you? Your risk stratification. What are you taking or not taking as a medication that will potentially reduce your immune competency, and make a decision. And of course, all of your health history, that is as much as I can say. As far as getting your immune system back on track, once you've removed yourself from an immune suppressing medication, it really depends on we're talking, there's a difference between what we call your memory B cells and how long they come back on track. So in other words, how does your historical immune function kick back in versus the immune function of new challenges? There are two different things that are happening in the body, and I will need to know a little bit more about your health history for me to comment any further. As to the far more intelligent and qualified doctors online, is there anything that we could add there for him?
So definitely not my area of expertise, but Scott, if you email me, I've got lots of resources that I can put you in touch with very, very easily. As a matter of fact, I'll bet you can get a call tonight and answer.
Oh, awesome.
If you do that, just email me and then I'll.
Yeah, I'll definitely do it. Thank you. I appreciate all of you. Any input anyone has.
Chris asked, do we have enough data to make a reasonable educated guess as to whether we will see a resurgence of cases later in the year? And since the virus replicates at an unprecedented rate, does it have a higher chance of evolving faster than, say, a new strain of the flu?
Second answer first. By logic and per what we see on in terms of viral behavior, because of the rate of replication, yes, there is the risk that this can mutate, and yes, that is a concern. But it's not just the rate of replication in the human beings, it's the rate of replication and the number of these coronaviruses that exist in the initial species, the bats, for example, which is where this is almost certainly from. The best of the research that's coming out of China right now is that, and by the way, we've seen other corona, there was the OC43, there was the HNK61, there are a number of cousins to the SARS-CoV-2. This one just happened to fit like a lock and key to the human cells. So not are we only going to have a concern with the rate of replication leaving the human body and for the risk of mutations, we're having. So the question here is not whether we would be exposed to. The best thinkers that are not sensationalizing are not saying if we're going to see this again. They're saying when we're going to see this again. Okay. And so that's for one. There was the first question was, can we make an educated guess as to?
Whether we'll see it later in the year. Yeah. I'm sure, you know, just like me, you guys are hearing either when it gets hot, this is going to go away, or when it gets hot, it's going to come back, and whether or not we'll see it again in the fall.
Again, the epidemiologic connections between heat. Listen, Singapore is right smack on the equation, the equator. So there are hot countries that have had to deal with this infection, and it's spread. Okay, so are there benefits, pros, cons when there's heat, there's humidity, the lining of, there's so many factors as to beyond just something simple saying it's no longer winter, it's summer, this is going to go away. I would not hang my hat on that. Can it have some benefit? We're opening up windows more. We're probably sure, but I wouldn't hang my hat on it. Is there enough information to say that this is going to come back into a phase two? The answer epidemiologically is no. We don't have a definitive amount of data to say so. We have enough data to say, without fear mongering, please, as communities, let us prepare.
Mansoor, you know what I think will happen, though, with the heat this summer is the flu will go away, just like it has every other year. So
such
that will make
a, such a beautiful
figure out what's going on, because that's
such a beautiful point.
Part of the confusion right now is that we don't know what's the flu and what's the coronavirus, what's strep, what's a cold. So in the summer, when it gets hot, we get over this next flu bump, but there is a big flu bump coming. It comes every single year, starting right now in Arizona, maybe a couple weeks later as you get further north or in colder climates. But we're going to run out of Tamiflu. We do every single year. And then we have to move from, and Tamiflu is around $70. And you can get it around $24, $25. You know how to shop for it. So it's affordable. The other drug, it slipped my mind. I can't remember. It's such a common drug, but it goes from $300 down to $90. So think about that. Now, when we run out of Tamiflu like we do every single year, there's no exception. We always run out of it. Our price point goes from $24 to $70 to $90 to $300, which means a lot less people can afford it. Yep. That's what I'm worried about with the second flu bump. And I'm not an expert in this. I'm just making up and applying logical sense to it. But I'm worried about the confusion that the flu will create in this second flu bump. But once we get to the summer, that goes away. It has every single year, we can predict it. And what we're left with is the coronavirus. So now we can we can be more certain about what we're dealing with. This, and maybe I'm just thinking from a healthcare.
No. You've just.
But I'm very excited for this flu season to be over with, so I know what I'm dealing with.
You hit it on the head again when we talk about the strain on the system, so that we could marshal our resources and focus on the issue at hand. So let's just refine that. So less about whether we know that the heat will take care of the SARS-CoV-2 or not. We don't have enough information to say yay or nay on that. We do have enough information to say that the summer will bring with it a reduction in these confounding infections. So we take that out of the equation. We take that angst out of the equation. We take that out of the stress on the healthcare system. And we can put our minds and our intellects and our systems to work on the infection. Which, you know, if we're smiled upon, also goes down, especially when coupled with the social distancing and the self-isolation that's going on right now. We can hope for that, we can, but to be very fair and to be responsible, we just don't know enough as yet as to what is the immunity rate to SARS-CoV-2. How long does that immunity last? The immunity for viruses do not last indefinitely. Right. And so we need to study that a little bit more.
Let me ask you another question here. Well, let's do a couple of quick ones because I know we've gone so over time. So thank you. Is there any way to determine based on its signature if the virus is bioengineered or not?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
listen, we have enough concerns without thinking of that, and I'm not being rude in the least. So the short answer, the sequence information of this virus, which is available, does show that it has fit like a glove onto the ACE2 in a way that is remarkable. But we have to understand that there are billions of these little critters, and it only takes one of those little critters to have all of the different evolutionary mutations to fit. So can this virus be doing what it's doing without any concern of whether this was biologically made or not? The answer is resoundingly yes. I will pause right there.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. So Matt asks, so kids seem to cope better with this. If a child has Down syndrome and a medical issue such as pulmonary hypertension, does the fact that they're a child mitigate those risk factors at all?
I don't know. I would put that child, if it was my loved one, and I would elevate my risk assessment because of the comorbidity. But can I say here that being a child with these comorbidities mitigates the risk of the infection? I don't know.
Is there anything that we didn't cover or that you'd like to share before we wrap up? And I would love to have you give out information about the DNA company and anything that would be helpful for everyone that is watching this and that will watch it, because I'm going to put this out publicly that people that you'd like to share.
The positivity, the recognizing that there's the bigger ripple effect. The ripple effect here is in many ways bigger than the actual infection itself, which is not to trivialize the actual infection. At the DNA company, we are a health-centric. It's about, and by the way, regardless of whether it's us, regardless, one thing that is going to come out and it's going to be beneficial. Look, you know, not trying to find silver linings where they don't exist. People are going to recognize that we cannot wait for medical emergencies to hit us. The sense of what we're in, this feeling that we're in right now, it is driving more people to take proactive steps. And that's what we'd created the DNA company. I was the director of genomics at Quest Diagnostics for many years. I was a core diagnostic geneticist, and I decided to put my effort to using genomics for health. How can you stay healthy? How can you learn about your bodies to be better and be more optimal? So this is what we do as a company. And I would end by saying, thanks to our CEO, we've redirected most of our resources to this app. It's an app that is designed to help with the confusion that Dr. Berg so beautifully enunciated and clarified. That's a huge part. The anxiety both on the patient, but as well as the weightiness on the healthcare system. So if we can do things in the self-management mode, self-management does not mean we cut out the clinician, but in the mode where we can be better informed. So I would encourage any of your listeners and those who listen to this we're making this app available through the DNA company, and there's a link on it. It is a work in progress that we accomplished it in less than a week.
Where can someone go to get the link? Because I want people to be able to hear it too. We can post that here. We'll put it on geniusnetworkinsights.com along with everything related that you've provided us with. And at the same time, if you could give out a link where people can get it.
So www.thednacompany.com. I'll type it here. And Joe, we'll make sure our team gets to you everything that you need to present to your folks and you need to put on your website. We'll get everything over to you. But just as I'm done speaking, I'll type in the link here for everyone.
There's a lot of fear over the test. And so the tests are limited, at least in Arizona, and they are much more needed in other parts, LA, Seattle, New York.
Yes, Louisiana, Louisiana is becoming a hot spot right now.
Yeah. And people are very stressed when we have to ration the tests or save them for the folks that have weak immune systems or diabetes or heart disease. But here's what's important to know for this group is that test will do nothing to speed up recovery. It'll do nothing to help you get better. All it will do is it'll just help us collect the numbers and it will help us put a seriousness on the quarantine need. And meaning if you have a positive test, it is vital that you just stay away from everybody. It's vital if you have the flu also right now, especially around older people. But a lot of people are stressed when we tell them, hey, you don't qualify for this coronavirus test, which just adds to the stress on the healthcare system because we don't have enough tests and we're not gonna have enough tests probably for a long time. So I would encourage you to not get too worked up if your doctor says the test is not for you right now. Most people on this call right now, you shouldn't get a test. Even if you're sick, you shouldn't get a coronavirus test unless you've got shortness of breath, some exposure, and you're immunosuppressed, et cetera.
Okay. Beautiful. Hey, this is Joe Polish. I hope you found that presentation with Mansoor incredibly valuable, especially the questions that the members asked. And so I wanted to make it easy for you to know where to go and get things that we had discussed. GeniusNetworkInsights.com is where you can download the reports that Mansoor had written. You can read the transcripts or listen to the other interview that I did with him. Also, if you want my book, you can get it for free, joesfreebook.com. You don't have to buy anything. You can just download the book there. Genius Recovery is where we have things related for people that are struggling with addictions, geniusrecovery.org. Genius Network, of course, is the main site. And then Dr. Mansoor Mohammed is the dnacompany.com. So you can find all of that there. And I hope you found this really valuable for you and your family and loved ones. Share this with anyone that you think would benefit from it.
Don't miss another episode of Genius Network. Subscribe today at geniusnetwork.com/subscribe. If you'd like to access the video, show notes, or the exercise to help you take action on what was discussed, please visit geniusnetwork.com/143.